Okay, good morning. We are finally going to start. Finally calling to order the. Thank you. Finally calling to order the meeting of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. And today, members, we are focusing on home visiting. And so we're going to start with a presentation, just giving us a briefing. We're going to address the minutes at another time from the past meeting. But we are going to start with this presentation by the Minnesota Department of Health and move into a bill relating to home visiting. And so if our testifier can identify herself, and then please feel free to begin.
Sure. My name is Dawn Reckinger, and I'm the manager of home visiting at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to be here, and I have about a 20-minute presentation, and then hopefully I'm covering what you're hoping to hear, and if not, then we can go to questions. So I think this group probably is pretty familiar with home visiting, but I'll give kind of a brief overview. Home visiting is really a voluntary service. Ideally, we start it prenatally. We like to get the moms in as early as we can. We know that if we can have a healthy birth, we've already mitigated a lot of things. We ideally serve the child usually until age 2 or 3. Sometimes we go up to even 4 or 5. Most of the home visiting in Minnesota is what we'd call long-term home visiting, where it's at least 6 months or more. We usually try to see the family for 2 to 3 years. So it's a long-term relationship. Home visiting is a large referral part that it has. It has referrals in, so the home visitors are constantly trying to get access to families that would do well with home visiting, so that might mean that they're well connected to WIC and trying to get the families that come through there. They're working with schools, they're working with homeless shelters, they're working with food shelves. They're really making connections into the community to try and identify the moms and families that are most at risk. It's also a huge referral out. So as they start serving those families have a lot of different needs. Obviously, if it's a pregnant mom, high on the list is trying to make sure that she is getting all her prenatal checks and is, you know, set up to have a healthy birth and delivery. After the child is born, we want to make sure that the child is getting their well child checks, that she is connected to, you know, a physician or nurse practitioner or some kind of primary care provider. We really encourage the moms to breastfeed, so a lot of it is getting them resources on doing that. The other parts is it's a long-term commitment to addressing the social, developmental, and psychological needs of the child. So there's constant assessments that are going on as the child develops. There's continuing education, because this is really a partnership. So the goal is, it's not that the home visitor comes in and they interact with the baby and do all this stuff. They really are teaching the parent, and typically it is the mom, although in a lot of cases we have, there's a growing number of dads being involved. Sometimes it's grandma who's involved. Sometimes with certain families where the parent might be, you know, incarcerated at a time or where the children are removed, you might be working both with the biological parent and with the foster parent and the child, but it's always a two-generational approach. So it's never just focused on the child, and it's never just focused on the caregiver or adult in the room. It's always a two-generational approach.
Ms. Rector, can I ask you just to adjust the microphone, or just adjust, yeah, your mouth and microphone, just to, I want to make sure you're being picked up.
Sure, yeah, I was kind of wondering.
Okay, yeah, maybe just, yeah, just adjust a little. Bit.
Sorry, right, no is problem. That a little better?
That's, yeah, that is.
Okay.
Thank you. Please continue.
Please let me know if I step back and you have
Thank
a hard
you.
Time here. And the other part is because it is home visiting, it's such a unique opportunity to be in the home and to view how safe the home is, parts that they can look at and say, hey, you know, we want to make sure that all your outlets are covered. We want to make sure that, you know, for many of you know, right, as what the how safety features that you would look for an infant, which would be probably focusing on safe sleep, to when all of a sudden the toddler is moving around and getting into things. So it's a really unique view of the family. And it also helps us see, because often when the home visits happen, even if it's the primary person involved is the mom, there often is a dad or a grandmother involved, and so you can see how the sort of other parts of the family are influencing the care and development of the child and the family dynamics. So it is a service that focuses largely on kind of the whole context. And as opposed to, the approach is really to empower and provide information and resources for that family to be the best parents that they can, to give their children the best opportunities, and to have a healthy child to develop and grow. So I'm going to move on. If you're following on the slides, I'm going to move to the one for need for home visiting.
Oh, so are you not able to change the slides?
Oh, I'm sorry. I can't see them. That's why I was
I think we thought you were on the first slide that whole time. Okay.
Sorry. So. This is one of those things where I feel like I know my topic really well, but I might be nervous about presenting.
So oh, no.
Coaching's
no,
okay.
No need to be nervous. No, just take your time and walk on through.
So we've been asked a lot about need for families, and I just want to point out you can grab different denominators, and we've worked a lot with the Targeted Home Visiting Coalition. I kind of had these numbers ready yesterday, so if we look at 0 through 4, so that would be like someone who's 4 years old and 364 days. Sometimes people also use the number 0 to 3. So the 0 to 4 is 102,000 kids that are under 200% of poverty, and the 0 to 3 is around 81,000. So they're not too far off. It just depends who you want to define as needs the services. So if you look at that, if you say right now we have 102,000 kids that are 0 to 4 under 200% of poverty, we are meeting about 14% of this need through MDH-funded programs. Now, I also want to point out, obviously, there are other home visiting programs, nonprofits, who this, I don't think really any state agency necessarily oversees. And also, there's a huge initiative, Early Head Start, through the federal government that somewhat is controlled more by MDE, and we don't oversee that. So when I say 14%, that is the data that I collect at the Department of Health. We know that 6% of the total need of the 102,000 is being met through what we would call evidence-based home visiting. And I'll just quick say, so evidence-based home visiting is where there are lots of research programs that have had anywhere from 10 to 30 years of research. It's sort of a packaged program where they've decided, you know, here's sort of the beginning, middle, end. Here are the key components. They've tested it as a package, and they've been able to show if you do this, you know, roughly in this sequence and see the child and the family for, you know, 2 years, we have demonstrated these outcomes. So when I refer to evidence-based, that's what I'm talking about. In the last year, we had served 12,400 pregnant women and families. There's a heavy focus. We always try to get women in their pregnancy, so 18% were pregnant. And then there's just some quick demographics. About 65% are white, 16% were African American, 6% Asian, 3% American Indian, and 9% had other words, multicultural or different categories. I'm going to go to the next slide. So who we serve. So teen parents is always a high priority. We have about, it changes every year, about 2,400 teen births every year. We don't, our statistics show that we aren't serving all of them. I think last I looked, we were serving about 1,600. That's not for lack of outreach by any means on the part of our agencies. You know, teens are, if you have a pregnant teen, they're having a lot of issues going on in their life. I think a quite sobering fact is, you know, we think of teens, and normally we would say 13 to 19. One of my staff had to come to me one day and say, are we including 10-year-olds? And so I had to say yes. So just know when we quote our statistics, it goes all the way down to 10. So we serve families that are facing a variety of challenges. Could be substance abuse, could be their own upbringing, where they've experienced trauma. Certainly poverty is a huge focus, just because they don't have access. And so that's why home visiting is so good for those families who don't have a lot of resources, because that home visitor is bringing in all these resources and getting them connected. So it could be anyone. We're really trying to focus now on homelessness, which takes kind of a new initiative, right, because it's home visiting, but you don't have a home to go to. So how do you meet with those families? How do you identify them? And obviously, we're seeing continuing increase in mental disorders and substance abuse. So I just wanted to point out a little bit the uniqueness of home visiting, because I'm sure you get a lot of programs that come across your desk, and you're probably trying to sort them all out. So one of the unique things about home visiting is it is a two-generational approach. It's never just focused on the child. It's never just focused on the caregiver. So it is a two-generational approach, and we, while most of it happens in the home, sometimes for a variety of reasons, most of them safety, there are reasons why the home visitor might meet either at the grandma's house, sometimes at McDonald's. Occasionally they'll come into a clinic if it's like one of our public health agencies. But we try and meet the, we love to get into the home, but there are safety reasons sometimes and other reasons. You know, the other parent or grandmother or dad might not allow the home visitor in, so we meet the clients where we're at and we do the best. I would say 75 to 80% of the visits actually occur in the home, but I thought it was a good thing for you to be aware that sometimes that doesn't happen. As I mentioned before, there's over 30 years of research on this with proven results. As a research social behavioral scientist, this is actually quite an amazing thing. Our government and our nation doesn't always invest in behavioral research, so the fact that we have such solid research on home visiting and consistent is really a kudos to the program. I've listed a couple of the probably more well-known programs that we've had in Minnesota for a long time, Nurse Family Partnership, Healthy Families America. In the last 5 years, we've really delved into Family Spirit. I'll bring up some of the other programs a little bit later. The other part is that home visiting shows improved outcomes for parents and children across their lifespan and across topic areas and also across the many models that I'm mentioning. So a lot of interventions can show an immediate return where you're just like, oh, look, the kid's doing better now, or they're doing better for about 6 months after the intervention. And one of the hallmarks of home visiting is that we show long-term results. As the child develops, as the mom develops. And if we go to my next slide, we can show some of that. So we also know that some of the national models have, because they've been doing this research for so long and they have these randomized control trials and large samples of people who have gone through this, they're able to actually start looking at return on investment. So we know that through some of them, for every dollar invested, depending on the model and the family they're serving, there's a $3 to $6 return is what they've shown. And if anyone wants more detail, we'd have to kind of look specifically into a model to get that. But what we do know in general is that home visiting improves prenatal health, it reduces childhood injuries, it reduces visits to the emergency room, it prevents subsequent unplanned pregnancies, it improves school readiness. Another huge push of home visiting is to space the births more, right? Give the parent, especially if we have a teen mom, we encourage her to, you know, finish her schooling, do well with this first one, then plan the next one. So the intervals between births are increased. And also we know that maternal employment and graduation rates. I can tell you for a pregnant teen, the rate of graduation is usually about 38% from high school. We have shown Ramsey County has a huge teen program. And as we know, we may in Minnesota, we have some schools that specialize and really kind of cater to teen pregnant teen parents. And the graduation rate at the school is around 68%, but we've shown that the ones that are receiving home visiting are anywhere from 78 to 85%. So it really has significant impacts. And then funding, I'm going to move into that, right? Because we're all like, how do we pay for it? Let me just catch up here. So home visiting is funded through a variety of methods. So a huge part that we oversee is our MDH grant funding. And I'll talk about the various funding sources of that in a few slides. Obviously, a lot of agencies can receive grants from foundations, United Way, you know, a local Bremer Foundation. There's third-party reimbursements. Not all home visiting agencies are able to seek reimbursement, but for those that do, we try and help them maximize it, and it can be a large portion. And then local levies, particularly if you're obviously a county or a city. We have many who invest a lot of their tax dollars into their home visiting program. So, and it varies widely. So we actually have, we did a survey a while, probably 4 years back, and we're seeking to do another one because it just varies so strongly, depending how much funding they're getting from us and whether they can bill or not. So to talk about the billing, right now, between CMS guidelines and Minnesota state law, PHN, which is a public health nurse, or a registered nurse that's supervised by a PHN, can bill for home visiting services. In 2017, the legislature passed an increase in rate for evidence-based home visiting, which is now $140 that they can bill. If it's just a pregnant mom, they bill the $140 rate. When it's the mom and the baby, they're long enough. There's a lot of factors that figure into this. They're usually able to bill for both the mom and the baby. So we're seeing now agencies that can sometimes get up to $280 for the visit that they're doing. Again, that is very limited to if you're a public health nurse or you're a public health or you're an RN supervised by a public health nurse. For others that,
Ms. Reckinger, do you mind taking questions in the middle of the presentation?
That's fine.
Yeah, then in that case, Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just as I've been listening attentively, and there's one question that that has been on my mind, you brought it up, the how long. So how long is a, I know that this is going to vary because it's not uniform that different programs have different ways of engaging and spending time in the home with the two generations. But can you comment also, and maybe even as it relates to billing, about the length of a visit and the frequency of visits?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I can't see your name, but
Representative Pryor.
And Representative Pryor. Sure. So I would say a typical home visit is probably they strive for 45 minutes to an hour. There's a lot of factors that go into that of whether, one, do they actually make the home visit. You have to remember these are families that are dealing with a lot, so cancellations are common. In fact, one of our models calls it creative outreach because the biggest goal is to keep that family connected. So you're connecting on their terms. So, and with our younger generation coming about, honestly, in some cases, it's not a visit and they wouldn't bill for it, but there's a lot of texting going on of like, how can I keep connected? How can I continue to be a resource for you? But when they actually get in the home, I would say that the shortest visit would probably be 30 minutes. Sometimes they can go an hour and a half. So I think when we say 45 minutes to an hour, that's sort of an average in what they would strive for. How the visits happen, you're right, really kind of depends on the model. But I would say in general, they would focus on where in a prenatal stage they'd be trying to visit the mom. And this depends on risk factors. But at least every other week, sometimes weekly. Again, because if you're only catching a mom when she's about 28 weeks and you're trying to get to, 40, really working and being consistent and trying to get to that healthy birth, a weekly visit is really warranted. And if the mom is willing to do it, and there it might be, maybe you're trying to do a 35-minute visit. From 0 to 6 months of age, again, we try to stay weekly or at least every other week. Once the child reaches 6 months of age, and again, this is all assessed independently, but in general, I would say they would move to every 2 weeks for sure, in general. So probably from prenatal to 6 months, ideally you're shooting for weekly. You're obviously working with the family, what they can do. From 6 months to about a year and a half, around a year and a half, you're probably doing every other week. And then from about a year and a half on, you're probably doing monthly or so, roughly, if that helps.
Okay. And then Representative Pryor, Heintzman has a question. Go for it. I had Representative Pryor on the brain. She was just finishing. So Representative Heintzman, yeah, pardon me.
Are we going to want to have questions throughout or at the end, Mr. Chair, before I start?
If it's okay with Ms. Reckinger, I think it can be really helpful to do it in the middle. So, Representative Heintz, I'll leave it up to you as to when you want to, but if you want to do it now, go for it.
All right. Well, it was just a page or two back. We don't need to go, but there was just a clarification I wanted to confirm. I think you had mentioned that in some cases when the folks coming to do the at-home visit are coming and they're trying to, make that happen, that sometimes dads are there and that isn't able to move forward. And I think that what you meant was somewhat different, but I just wanted a clarification, because I'm assuming that there's dads like me, and my wife is one of those folks that she's like, no, not right now. And I'm the one that's stuck having to say, you know, we're not going to do this or that or the other. Is there a way to confirm that these folks that are interrupting that opportunity to conduct a visit have, I mean, I guess I'm trying to figure out, what is their intent? Do we know? Do you know what I'm saying?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure, Mr. Chairman and Representative Heisman, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it would happen. Thank you for clarifying that. It would be on an individual basis, and we would, you know, the home visitor's there and making that connection. I think what we hear, I guess, when we talk to them, because we have seen an increase in the number of visits that are happening outside the home, so we've started asking, because they've asked about billing for it. And so now we're trying to get clarification on, like, what can they bill for and stuff like that. So we've also started asking, you know, why is that happening? Why are more visits happening outside the home? And what we're hearing is usually it's a safety reason. There certainly could be times where, you know, the family's just got a lot going on, right? They're about to lose their apartment and someone got fired from their job and they're like, I am not doing a home visit today. And the home visitor, of course, adapts to that. They often try and help to some degree, like, how can I help? How can we, you know, stabilize? How can we get you food for the week or whatever the immediate needs are? And then we'll reschedule the home visit that we were going to do. So there's always that accommodation. I think there are some cases where we're hearing with teen parents who, you know, there are a lot of families, not a lot, there are some families that will kick a kid out when they're pregnant. You know, whoever they're staying with, a lot of the families are couch hopping. So whether it's it may not be the father, but it could be the person who is, you know, owns the house and doesn't want another person coming into their house. So they may say, I don't want a home visitor coming into my house. So that's another reason why we go meet at separate places. Does that help answer your question?
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sure. It really does. I just wanted to make sure that dads weren't getting a bad rap here, because I'm pretty sure there's lots of other scenarios, and I appreciate your expanding on that a little bit.
As a fellow dad, I'm standing with you, Representative Heisman, on that. There are some good dads standing up for their kids. So then please continue, Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. And I'll just say, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, I'll just say one other thing is we are seeing actually an increase in in our massive data collection, mark who is the primary caregiver, and we also mark who are the other caregivers we see. We see a continued increase in the primary caregiver being the dad. So in fact that we, there aren't a lot of male home visitors, but, we're seeing, I mean, literally there's probably less than five, in the state that we oversee. But the fact that we've gone from like two in the last year to now having, about five or six male home visitors is significant. And a lot of that is because, the agencies are seeing a need to involve dads more. So there's an increased, targeting for that. So. Continue to ask those questions. We support dads as well. Okay, so I think it was on the last part of the billing. There is also, excuse me, community health workers can bill. It's at a much lower rate. As you know, rates are kind of protected information, so I would say anecdotally we're sort of hearing that the rates are probably under $30, but because usually they're by county and they're negotiated with the PMAPs, and so... and then one part I wanted to point out is on the tribal nations, they have what are called community health technicians, which have very similar training, but slightly different from what a community health worker is. They're not encompassed under the community health worker bill. They cannot bill. So just to make that distinction in case, you know, it's easy to think like, oh, they can all bill. They actually can't. So if we go to the next funding slide. I thought it would be good to just give you kind of a general overall. So starting this coming July, and in large part because of the investments that our state has made, we'll be overseeing $36 million per year in both federal and state funding. So we're very happy about that. $8.5 million of that is through the TANF allocation for family home visiting, which is covered under statute 145A.17. Just to note that in the statute, it allows the counties and the tribal nations, they can use it for home visiting, they can use it for WIC nutrition, and they can use it for teenage pregnancy prevention.
Ms. Yeah. Reckinger, a question from Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just like a slide behind, but if you don't mind. So you talked about the billing for it, and there's a list of resources for billing. And then is it sometimes an agency or a group that's doing the home visits, do they bill from one of those? Do they bill to a combination of those? How do those sources flow together? Are they braided together or are they all separate?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we require, and the federal government requires, the funding that we come, that funding sources must be braided. So at any time, I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, you could trace that. However, we do encourage people when they're approaching their program, whatever that is, whether they have a short-term program, a long-term program, whether they have evidence-based model, whatever their comprehensive program is, we encourage them to think about the budget comprehensively. But when they're actually billing, you should be able to trace it.
Okay. And please continue. And I should probably say, Ms. Reckinger, members, as I'm thinking about it, I think we should probably plan to start on the bill by about 8:45, or at least I'd love to do that, just make sure we have plenty of time. If you can keep an eye on that, and then it may well be that, that's fine. I think that the two may well blend. I suspect that in discussing the bill, we'll be discussing general topics as well. So, but just sort of keeping an eye on that.
Sure.
On that time.
I was just really
like,
I can't see a clock.
It's about 12.
Can I 12, grab my phone real quick so I can just watch the time?
Feel free to, and it's about 12 minutes away, Ms. Reckinger, so we should be in decent shape. I just thought I'd give a heads up.
Sorry about that. Okay, so you'd like me to be down by like 8:50?
Sure, about 10 minutes or so, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Most counties use the majority of their TANF allocated funding for home visiting. We find that tribal nations, 9 of the 11 accept the TANF funding, tend to use it more broadly across all three areas. WIC is heavily supported, teenage pregnancy prevention, and home visiting. So it varies, and the statute allows them that flexibility. For the new state funding, that really allowed us to expand the evidence-based models, and we have a lot of funding. About 75% of our funding actually is allocated specifically to the startup or expansion of evidence-based home visiting models. So we get $9 million from, we call it MCV, it's the federal funding. In 2015, there was $2 million that the state allocated specifically to nurse-family partnership, and then, of course, in 2017, there was the $6 million per year startup, and then the $16.5 million, which will start this July. If we go to the next slide, I'll just do a quick overview of the new state funding. So as I just mentioned, it was, if you add the $6 million, it's $12 million over the first biennium, $33 million over second bienniums. The new funding will serve approximately 2,200 families each year. And how we come up with that is, we have looked nationally because we've had the federal dollars for a long time, and obviously we've been looking at our own costs, so we know cost per family. And we used to have, when we first started out with MCV, we had a cap, and across the nation they did, of about $5,000 per family. We heard repeatedly from our implementing agencies that was too low, that they were having to supplement too much. And so we've raised the cap now to $6,500 per family. If any of you, I'm sure, are reading our recent RFP, we also all are really encouraging collaboration and regional partnerships. And so we do allow additional up to $1,500 per family if an agency is pursuing really strong outreach to specific areas, or if they are approaching this in a regional collaboration. You've heard me talk a lot about evidence-based models. One of the handouts you have, and I'm not going to go over it, but I just wanted it, and sorry, it's such small print, but it lists all the 6 evidence-based models. It's kind of a table form that you should have available. I'd be happy to answer more detailed questions at another time, or at the end of questions. There we're very lucky that the federal government has taken such a strong interest in home visiting that they have a designated site, and it's called HomeV, a website, and they have lots of researchers and highly qualified people who know a lot about home visiting and research that review models constantly and are always updating the work on them. And so there are 47 models that have been submitted for their review. Of those, 17 meet the Department of Health and Human Services federally criteria, which is basically that they show strong outcomes in at least two maternal or child health areas, and that they have certain levels of research that demonstrate that those outcomes. Minnesota has chosen to focus on 6 of those models, and you may ask why. Like, why wouldn't we just let everyone do all the, you know, whatever model they wanted? And it's a question we struggle with. Part of it is what kind of technical assistance can we provide, and then also when you think about these families are highly mobile, and if they're moving from one area to another and all of a sudden that model isn't available, that doesn't do the family very well. Right now, for a long time, we had only distributed funds to cities and counties and tribal nations. With the new legislation in 2017, we're also now including nonprofits. And the majority of funding goes to support long-term home visiting. And there's a list of the models. Basically, the only short-term one we have right now is called Family Connects. Okay. Good. These are short slides. So I'm going to show you. This is sort of a progression of how the spread of evidence-based and has happened. And let me just clarify this. So we've had TANF funding for home visiting since 2003. So Minnesota is very fortunate, especially when we talk to our colleague states. Any child born in any county, any tribal nation, can get a home visit. If you call your local public health department, you will get a home visit. It may not be a long-term home visit. And you may get like 2 or 3, or they'll help you get settled, you know, get what you need immediately. They just may not have the resources. And a good example is, so Little Cook County, way up in the far right, they have 30 births a year. Their TANF allocation is $4,000. So you can imagine that doesn't hire many home visitors. So in 2012, ignore the colors, just look at whether it's white or colored. This was the spread of home visiting at that time. In 2015, we received a $10 million increase in our federal funding. The federal funding has gone up and down. And so there is the spread. Again, look at basically white versus not. And then here is where we are in 2018. Sorry, it's in gray. Probably should have done it in a better color. But there's about 12 counties, I think, if you count them up, that are still in white. And we just finished our current RFP, and I can't give you the details, but I can tell you that 8 of those counties are going to turn to a color, which we're happy to see. So that just kind of shows the progression. And I think what we'd like to say, what we believe is that while evidence-based home visiting may not meet the needs of every family, there certainly are extenuating circumstances, we feel that having access to an evidence-based home visiting raises the quality and level of home visiting for that agency and across the county and tribe and nonprofit.
And Ms. Reckert, your question for Representative Cutizza-Witun.
I'm sorry, what?
A question for Representative Cutizza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. I just wanted to clarify. So, I mean, it looks like we're making great progress with available funds for this programming across the state. Is the so the counties who don't yet have funding and with this upcoming RFP will be covered, is it based on a much lower birth rate in those counties or what kind of?
I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear the line. Was it based on a much lower?
Based on a lower birth rate in that county, because you mentioned 30 births a year in Cook County. That's one of the ones that still is white on the,
sure,
on the slide. Is that,
yeah,
common across those counties?
Ms. Reckinger.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple factors. So for a long time, in 2012 and 2015, the primary evidence-based funding we had was through the federal government, which was MCVI. So with their TANF funding, they could choose what they wanted to do, and many counties did choose to convert some or all of it to evidence-based. But MCDI has a, they require the states to rank the counties. And so, you know, we have 87 counties, and I think we were able to give funding to about 45 of them. And basically, they encourage you to give it to people who are in not good ways above the state average. So, right, they have higher infant mortality or, you know, some higher risk factors. So Cook County would have been a county, for example, that just didn't qualify for the MCDI funding, so we couldn't give it to them. So the nice part about the state funding, and that's why you see such a dramatic, you know, if you look at the southern part of the state, you see all those white areas. So in parts of it, we would say, wow, those counties are doing pretty well, but it doesn't mean that they don't have families that couldn't receive services. So with the advent of the state funding, they were able to apply and receive the funding. And one of the things that we've really pushed, and I guess maybe this will help speed up my other ones, is it's hard. It's you don't just start an evidence-based home visiting program and, you know, I'm ready to go tomorrow. It takes a lot of infrastructure. Most of the agencies that we fund are already running, you know, good home visiting programs, but it's a new way of doing it. And it's certainly the data collection, it's following fidelity to the model. And so being able to partner together has been huge. So we have really encouraged that, to economies of scale, to share resources. And so that, I think, has also played a big factor in why now more counties, one, the funding's available, and two, they actually feel like they haven't, they could do this.
Okay. One follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Cadiz-Witun.
Thank you. I'm just curious, for the families who may live on a county border of a county that, in a county that doesn't have service available, but next to a county that does, do they have access to the services in the county next door or not?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a good question. So I'll just go back to the part of, like, every county does have access to TANF funding. And so they do have some level of home visiting. So if, you know, even in Cook County, where they only have 30 births, they have a universal program there. So and they have a public health nurse, and she visits every new mom in that county. Now she probably only visits them for a few visits, to make sure. If she did have someone who is interested in long term, we don't see that. Our funding doesn't prevent it. We just don't see that happen. And part of that could be that they have a long history of us giving money county by county by county by county. So we're sort of breaking down those barriers of saying, no, we're giving money to your region. You decide how to spend this, and you adjust. We don't need to be deciding that at this state. So in general, right now, I would say no. But I think we're hoping to change that.
So service is accessible.
Representative Cadiz-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Service is available in every county. It's just not necessarily as comprehensive.
Ms. Reckinger.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would say most are not getting long-term home visiting.
Thank you. Thank you, okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
So, and by that, they might, you know, it could be from a couple visits up to like 6 months or so, but certainly not the long-term.
And Ms. Reckinger, Representative Heintzman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quick, I'm looking at this 2018 slide, and I see Crow Wing, my county, is in a white shade, so I'm assuming that this program hasn't extended, at least by 2018, to Crow Wing County. Am I reading that correctly?
Ms. Reckinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct. Crow Wing County has not, they have been eligible or haven't applied for some of the funding.
And Representative Heintzman.
So my question would be relative to my own experience. And so when our kids were coming early on in the 2000s, quite a ways back, I recall at St. Joseph's Medical Center, there was a in-home visit program available, and they were offering that to our family. Is that something that hospital was doing on its own? How would that have been working, I guess, is what I'm wondering.
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a good question. So we have seen in probably the last 10 to 15 years, could be a little longer, where hospitals are doing their own form of home visiting. And usually it's a temporary kind of like a follow-up after the birth, making sure everything is going well. It's usually a couple visits. It's not long-term. It's not an area that we have any level of jurisdiction over. We don't fund it. So in a way, I'm probably not going to be able to answer your question very well because it's not under our purview, but we have seen that happening. I would say, again, anecdotally, what we know is that it's usually by a nurse employed by the hospital and that they're going out, and usually it's sort of a well-child in-home visit, and I guess you may know more than I do. What I've heard is they're not long-term. It's usually 1 to 3 visits.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not clear on how long that might be available, but I do think it's important to note that there probably is a lot of other similar programs like what we were offered when we had our babies, and they may look as though there was no service in these counties across the state, but it could be that it was to some extent, maybe not a long-term situation, but it certainly was available.
And Ms. Reckinger, any comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's where maps, you know, they're wonderful and yet they can be deceiving, is I want to keep reiterating because I might not be saying it strongly enough, is that in every county there is some level of home visiting. So even though Crow Wing in here and Cook County are in the white, we know that there's home visiting. This is a specific map to talking about evidence-based, kind of those packaged home visitings that we feel have the most significant proven outcomes, and that's why we track it. And it's also where 75% of our funding is designated, so that's another reason why we track it. So if I was to show you a map that said where is any home visiting available, I would just fill in the whole state because there is home visiting, and you're correct. And Crow Wing County actually does, they have created their own program. They do see families. They, you know, strive to see them longer term. They, we've certainly been in contact with them of trying to get them to convert over. You know, doing an evidence-based program is, it's hard work.
And Ms. Reckinger, so I want to get going on the bill. It looks like your final slides certainly have some important topics in them. I wonder if you can give us a high-level overview for now,
sure.
Because I don't want to just skip over them, and then we can circle back with questions as we have time.
Yeah, I think the main one, so we have a strong evaluation that we continue mm-hmm. to want to improve. With the new MCV funding we've gotten in the home visiting, we are investing in a changeover. I think one of the things that might be interesting for this body to know is our home visiting agencies, some are using paper and some have very advanced electronic health records. So we're trying to combine all of that to how can we bring the data to the state and answer all the questions that you guys might have of like, well, are we really making an impact? And, you know, how much did that cost and all those things? We actually feel like we're on track. So we are making some big changes, and hopefully the end of this year we'll see that where we have one data repository and can query it much more. So that's mainly that slide.
Oh, yeah, Representative Franson, yeah, please.
It took us a while to get to this slide.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
So earlier you had mentioned the term massive data collection. And I am wondering, massive is not small. It's mm-hmm. rather large. It's rather big. Could you please share what type of massive data collection is under home visiting?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. It's a good question. Thank you. We go by there are 19 federal benchmarks that we go by. We collect data at the client level and at the visit level. So part of it is often it's repeated. So we have everything from, you know, postpartum depression screenings that are done on periodic basis. We have developmental screenings that are done with the children. We have some requirements that our federal government requires that literally have a marking every visit that they do. So we receive client-level data. Now, they have the option of if we can receive the full data where literally we would see the name. The client has to give consent. We can't collect anything without the client's consent. The client can say, I'm willing to give all the information, I'm willing to give a limited data set, or I actually don't want to be included in the state's data set at all. So just know that they have that option, and we respect that, and so does the federal government. And I think the massive part would be in the eye of the beholder. So the
home visitors feel like the data collection that they're required to do for the models and for the state benchmarks, you know, takes time out of their regular visit of what they'd be covering in materials. So they'd rather spend all of it on the time that they have with the family. I'm not sure if I'm getting at your question.
No. Representative Franson.
Sorry.
No, because that doesn't cover what the massive is. You said now it's in the eye of the beholder, but to you it seems massive. And then you mentioned that the visitor would rather spend time with the client instead of going over because it takes up a part of their day. So apparently it's got to be pretty, it's got to be a big packet that they've got to go through.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so at 3 months when we do a lot of the developmental screening and the postpartum depression screening, they would do a questionnaire with the mom, and it would, you know, check on her depression levels, and they would do that. Every 3 months, I think it is, that they do the ages and stages questionnaire. So they are helpful to finding out if the child is on track. The hard part is the data entry that's required afterwards. So in terms of mass, we do collect a lot of data, and because we collect it at the visit level, it is a lot of data that we collect, and we collect it on 12,000 families per year.
And with their consent is what you're
with,
saying.
Yeah, completely. Okay. With their consent.
Representative Franson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are those... is it a condition of receiving Medicaid services to do, so there's no coercion, right? Like, if you don't participate here, you're not going to get this for your family or for your child. And then do you allow the parents to see and choose how their data is used or shared? Now, with the nonprofits awarded grants, I assume that those nonprofits will have their own set of criteria in order to follow up on the home visiting. I'm guessing that they'll, because you're going to award nonprofits, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, and then will those nonprofits have their own set of criteria in order to participate in this home visiting? You will have to abide by our standards, which may be different than your standards.
Ms. Reckinger, there are a couple questions in there.
Yeah, sure. Like. Yeah, I might ask you to repeat a few. So first of all, let me clarify outright. They have to have the parents' consent on file. And they actually, in our data collection, they have to check a box that say this parent consented to. And there is no coercion. In fact, while we would never do it with the state funding, and our federal funding requires us to say that you cannot deny services because of someone doesn't want to participate. So we take that very seriously, and we, and for those who don't want to participate, usually we just get a count. So, you know, like Ramsey County might say, and we had 20 families who didn't want to participate, or, you know, whatever the number is. And then that's all we get. We just know that there were 20 families and we don't get anything else. So we take that very seriously. I think you were asking about, the nonprofits. And so they're going to have, you're right, every agency has their own consent process of how they do it, and forms can be a page long to 4 pages long. We don't dictate what their forms are. We have tried, because we've been asked to help them share forms across, and everyone can see how are you asking for consent and how do you train your home visitors to get it. So we play a technical assistance role, but we don't, other than saying that they must have a consent, and we do require that we have a copy of their consent, their form. We don't actually dictate what they put on it or how they approach their family. Does that answer your question?
Representative Franson.
Yes, but just now the follow-up, do you allow the parents to see and choose how their family's data is used? Because the data is going to be analyzed, shared with researchers, the nonprofits, government agencies. How in depth do you get with that parent and say, this is what we do with your data, and how long is it on file for?
Ms. Reckinger.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a very good question. So the data for home visiting is actually highly, highly protected. So even though literally right down the hall from me is WIC, I can't share any of our data with them. I actually can't share our data with anyone. So you're referencing like it's, you know, researchers and federal agencies. Actually, it's not. So they can't. When we do put it, there are some efforts, and we're not fully participating yet, but there are some thoughts of let's put it into the early childhood database. It would all be de-identified. There would be no identifications if that ever takes full place. But right now, you know, in part, you would think that in the Department of Health, I would even be able to link it with birth records. I can't. The data is so protected that we can't share it.
I wonder, Representative Francis, is it okay if we get the bill in front of it? Do you have another follow-up right now? Or is it okay? Okay. Ms. Reckinger.
Yes, let me just quickly go through. You know what, for the continuous quality improvement, all I'll say is we have some very innovative methods that we use to help agencies see their higher level data and to make improvements. You can read more about that. I think just maybe for the challenges is that, you know, these are long-term programs. Ideally, they're trying to serve the family for 3 years. And so if we would only give them funding 1 year at a time, that makes it very difficult for them to plan and do that. So we're trying to look at how we can extend and how we give out funding so that we can provide the most stability at the local level. We also find that, again, it's not easy to do these programs. They're well worth it, but we need to provide different levels of assistance, just like we did to the, if you look at the 2012 map, we, for those agencies that were starting then, we provided a ton of technical assistance. Now we're going larger, and so we're just finding that we have to do more of that. I think and maybe just one part is, and I referred to this earlier, is, you know, sometimes you do things and you know it's the right thing to do and you hope it'll be successful. And so one of the things we did is we allowed agencies to partner together, which is not typically how state agencies or certainly MDH has done its work. Usually we're like, okay, agency A, we're giving you this money, and agency B, we're giving you this money. And instead we said, you know, because families move around, even within a regional area. And so it was, and my husband's a family practice doc, so he's like, you know, he doesn't want to refer someone in Anoka and then have them move to Washington County and all of a sudden they can't get services. So we did take the approach about 3 years ago of saying, apply together. I mean, to be honest, we would love it if the whole state applied as one. and that way they can determine what their community needs. We can then play the technical assistant role that they need. And that has just been incredibly successful. We actually have two tribes that have partnered with counties, which is really unheard of. So I suppose that would be the last innovation that I think, and I would say the evidence-based home visiting funding allowed us to do that because we had enough to fund more people, more agencies.
Thank you, Ms. Reckinger. So again, I'm inclined to get going on the bill, and presumably this broader conversation about home visiting will be connected with that as well. So we'll call Representative Bonner up. And the clerk had taken the role, I asked her to do that earlier, and we do have a quorum. In fact, I think we have everybody present, which is great. And so we have Representative Bonner moving House File 1226, put it before us. And I believe, Representative Bonner, that you have an author's amendment. And so we'll have you move that as well, the DE1. To put it in the shape to which you would like to have it. Any discussion on the author's amendment? Anybody has? And hearing none, all in favor of adoption of the author's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. So House File 1226 is in the form that Representative Bonner would like it to be. And Representative Bonner, I'm turning things over to you and your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I wanted to start today with just a little bit about this. We know, for example, that there's, well, I have to be honest with you, I'm pretty excited to be here talking about this today. House File 1226, for home visiting services really serves pregnant women, parents and young children, it makes a really big difference in having these home visiting services and being able to provide sort of a stabilizing support for families that experience high risk factors where they're most comfortable, in their homes and in their communities. And we know that the families that receive these visits from trained professionals and paraprofessionals have access to healthcare services that improve pregnancy and birth outcomes. We know that we have opportunities to develop secure attachment with these children, improving their social, physical, and mental well-being, while improving maternal health and employment rates, as well as building vital connections into the community. With that, I am pretty excited to dive right into this bill today. We do have some testifiers before us today, and I will hand that over so we can get started.
And so we'll have our first testifier introduce yourself, please, and then feel free to begin. And you can state and spell your name for the record.
Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chandra Bittman. I'm the Director of Families Together at LifeTrack.
And would you mind spelling your name?
Chandra, last name Bittman, Bittmann.
Great, thank you, and please begin.
I'm here today on behalf of LifeTrack and the Minnesota Targeted Home Visiting Coalition. The coalition seeks stable funding statewide for targeted home visiting services, and increased support for home visiting as a core early child service. At LifeTrack, we understand that parents play the most important role in their child's early development and learning at home. Our team of home visitors go into the home and provide culturally appropriate services centered around health and well-being, child development, parent education, and parenting support. Many families referred to LifeTrack's home visiting programs come to us for voluntary support after being ineligible or closing out of county-based services such as child protection. With a holistic approach, home visitors both coach and teach the parents the importance of early childhood development and focus on how they can best meet the needs of their families. At the same time, they're assessing the individual needs of the family and providing referrals to other LifeTrack programs or the services of our partner agencies to help stabilize the home. At LifeTrack, we offer both evidence-based and evidence-informed home visiting programs. We offer multiple types of home visiting programs because of the diversity of experiences and situations families present themselves with when we first meet them. Giving families access to different types of home visiting programs allows us to best meet their needs. With additional home visiting funds, programs like LifeTrack may have the opportunity to engage additional families and in our programs. We hope the legislature will continue to invest in home visiting services for families. We know these early investments have positive lifelong impact on families and their children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our next testifier, please introduce yourself and state your name for the record, and please begin.
Excuse me. Good morning, committee chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marie Lynn Herrera, spelled Marielynn, last name Herrera. I am the program manager for New American Families, a home visiting service provided at YWCA Mankato. Our evidence-informed home visiting services specifically supports immigrant and refugee women and their families in Mankato, North Mankato, and St. Peter area. We use an evidence-based curriculum and have a team of trained paraprofessionals that go into the home and provide culturally appropriate same language services centered around health and well-being, healthy child growth and development, and parent education and support. YWCA Mankato began working alongside immigrant and refugee families in our community to improve school readiness because too often their children were entering kindergarten with fewer skills necessary to support educational attainment. Their barriers to access early childhood education stemmed from their unfamiliarity with how to connect to these opportunities and basic health and wellness services. Specifically, we understood that low-income immigrant and refugee parents confront unique obstacles to ensure their children are prepared for school. These experiences may include severe poverty and limited opportunities in their home country, and the loss of extended family and cultural framework for parenting. In our rural communities, isolation is only magnified among the mothers and families we serve, and transportation access is even more impaired. The structural barriers and limited resources of low-income immigrant parents often results in these parents being the only educational resource for their children. Our approach at YWCA Mankato is a collaboration with mothers that builds on their basic bond with their children to remove barriers to participation in their child's education and development, connect families with local providers to improve family well-being and health, and strengthen their connection to the community. This approach empowers families to expand their contributions within our community, contributing to and creating a more equitable society. We know our home visiting program makes a positive impact in the lives of families we serve, as well as the Mankato area. In written feedback from one of our mothers, she had this to say, "I would like to thank my friend, Reyna Thomas, who is our home visitor, for insisting and demonstrating to me the YWCA program. I am thankful to the program for the opportunity to learn more as a mother and for teaching my son more about what he learns in school. I am also thankful to the Museum of Mankato, which is the Southern Minnesota Children's Museum, for giving our family the opportunity to have a space to come together as a family and learn as a family. This highlights important virtues of home visiting. The value of having someone with a similar life experience as your own enables trust and influence to motivate families to use resources. In addition, honoring a parent's wisdom helps them feel effective in their role as parents. Services such as ours can provide tangible connections to community programs and activities that help families build relationships and create valuable memories in their community. We hope the legislature will support funding for home visiting programs so all families can gain the assistance they want and need so they can feel welcomed and supported by their community. Thank you."
Thank you. And then our third testifier.
Good morning.
Thank you. If you can pull the microphone towards you so that just you can be picked up. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and member of the committee. For the record, my name is Nedra Robinson. You spell it N-E-D-R-A-R-O-B-I-N-S-O-N.
Thank you.
I'm a senior early childhood specialist at Simpson Housing Services. Simpson Housing Services is a nonprofit providing assistance to people experiencing homelessness. Our programs include an emergency shelter, single adult supportive housing, and family supportive housing. And we strive to find affordable housing for all families. At any given time, we provide supportive housing to 100 individuals and 210 families with over 500 children. Unfortunately, there are more children experiencing homelessness in Minnesota than adults. At Simpson Housing, as an early childhood specialist, I go into the home and provide services centered around health and well-being, child development, parent education, and parenting support. The parents we serve are under extreme stress and experiencing trauma and are often focused on just getting through each day with their family. Our goal is to support parents through these intense times and provide them with the opportunity to focus on meeting the developmental needs of their children while we stabilize and help stabilize the family for long-term success. We know our program works. One of our former parents, I'll call her Cheryl, is evidence of that. Cheryl was a participant in our young parent program and lived in one of our site-based apartment buildings. Cheryl was a victim of brutal domestic and sexual violence. I and other staff members actually saw her try to kill herself by running into oncoming traffic. She was trying to get herself run over by a car. Her boyfriend and the father of her child routinely abused her and used drugs profusely. Her son, who was very young when we first met him, experienced trauma to the point that he was not developing language. He used a guttural language and was extremely violent himself. He would have uncontrollable tantrums. We worked with both of them and made sure he had intervention through Frazier. It was a long road, but eventually things turned around for them. She is now a program manager at PPL, and her son is developmentally appropriate in behavior. He's learning and completely ready for kindergarten. HF1226 provides flexibility to the Minnesota Department of Health to fund evidence-informed programs. Without these legislative changes. Home visiting program like ours at Simpson Housing and other high evidence-informed programs may not be eligible to apply for state funding. We hope you will support FH1226. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, are there questions for the testifiers? And not seeing any, are there? Is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on House File 1226? Head on up, please. Oh, and we did have somebody signed up. My apologies, Linda Bell. I'm not sure if that's the person heading to the microphone now or if it's a different person, but we can have, and really either way, I guess we'll have Ms. Bell go first, and then we'll have the other testifier and any other member of the public. And so please introduce yourself when you're ready, and please share your statement, share your thoughts.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and committee members. My name is Linda Bell, for the record, LindaBell. That should be an easy one to spell. And I represent Minnesota Advocates and Champions for Children. Home visiting in Minnesota has played a supportive role in helping women after the birth of their child. We are thankful to the visiting nurses and the many organizations here today who are doing very, very good work in this area. First, I'd like to thank the author for removing the 3-year requirement for new mothers, that in that way mothers may choose to whether or not they wish to go forward with home visits. As the visiting nurses and others have said, 6 months might be enough, 2 visits might be enough if it's a little low weight birth baby, but taking away the requirement, we appreciate that. All right, first, our organization has been working on data bills for the last 5 years here at the legislature. If you're newer this year, thank you, we're glad you're here, thank you for serving. And this has become an area of expertise for us. So in this case, expectant mothers, babies, and toddlers, and early childhood data is also an important issue to us. Speaking of data, though we are hearing today of many home visit organizations, Help Me Grow is an interagency organization working on behalf of the Department of Health and Education, and is a referral service for home visits working in tandem with the public schools. Referrals are made directly to the Department of Education website via the Help Me Grow data portal. Following data input, the school district picks up the information, making the family contact, and going forward with a home visit. Here's the catch and our concern. Parents may have no idea that their babies, toddlers, or children have been referred. Actually, parents may not even know or ever know that a data profile was created. Help Me Grow openly requires professionals to refer a child to the child's local school district if they, or, the statement is always or, it's not and, the child's parents are concerned about any aspect of the child's development. And of course, Help Me Grow is very much based on developmental milestones. That's much of what their website is about. And so the statement, again, I'll just read it to you. This is, they have a section for families. They have sections for professionals. And these are going to be your doctors, your nurses, and so forth. As a professional, you must refer a child to the child's local school district if you or the child's parents are concerned about any aspect of a child's development. This statement, and there's more, you know, it just says you may use the Help Me Grow system to make a referral. So this statement does not show mutual consultation, and it seems to be, there are other things on the website that show additionally the same sort of thing, the same sort of idea. In the end, data may have been entered into the system on the infant or toddler without ever offering parental notification or consent. MAC would encourage transparency at all levels of the referral system and to add a short opt-in statement or for consent before personal information is collected or shared. This catch-22 of data collection is invasive, especially when we know data can be used against you, profiling, in this case, an infant or a toddler, perhaps a mother or a family. Additionally, from testimony over the last 5 or 6 years, we know that the K-12 sled, since we're talking about the early learning sled, essentially, the K-12 sleds have not been audited in over 14 to 15 years. We're talking about here the third-party contracts that the K-12 sleds maintain, and this changes sometimes from year to year. And so they have not been audited. We really don't know what's going on with these third parties, that they are giving state information about our children to these 40 entities. And that of course, is from the Office of Higher Education. Although that data is sanitized, data experts will tell us that this data could easily be reconstituted. You know, students are using the state student ID number, SSID number. That's also their lunch code number in the schools. All of that is sitting on the school district websites. It would be so easy to tie in a name and that SSID number. It wouldn't even take anybody that was very involved or knew very much about technology. They could hack into it. All right, secondly.
Ms. Bell, can I just ask a quick question? It seems like the bill doesn't relate to help me grow, so I'm just trying to understand the connection.
This is the system that is at work.
Okay.
Thank you. System that is at work as we talk about home visits.
Thank you.
I have not a problem with home visits. Okay. I'm talking about the system that's wrapped around. Organization, essentially, is the BUILD initiative, which was brought in to help implement the Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge. And they also have a home visit portion, and so I'm going to talk about the home visit portion.
Okay, what I ask if you can confine your testimony to the bill, home visiting and the bill, if you wouldn't mind.
So,
thank you.
With the home visits, the BUILD initiative is pushing doctors to predictively diagnose students to put them into the home visit programs. Here, on one of their studies just brought out in 2014, it states, a mother brings her six-month-old in for a checkup, and it's clear that the mom is stressed, poorly dressed, and shows little sign of responding to the child's cues for attention. While the child isn't diagnosable today, if things proceed as the primary health practitioner expects, in 2 years there will be significant indicators of development delay and likely social and emotional problems, including a DSM-4 diagnosis. And I can continue, but just to say this is predictive diagnosis that the doctors are being, these are the ideas that are being promoted by some of the organizations that I believe the Minnesota Legislature funds. This is predictive diagnosis, and it's just not something that we can really get behind. So, and then the next question there, of course, is this exploitation? Is this equity? Really? Is it equity, or is this actually exploitation? And this would mean that perhaps, not the bill so much, but how it is working in the system may not be what this bill and for whom it wishes to serve. Okay, you want to serve these people, but considering the system that's out there, in some parts, we could have some exploitation going on. In the end, this bill is missing protections for those organizations that are not asking for consent. And on the other end, doctors are being nudged to predictively diagnose children and babies and mothers. I would highly encourage protections to be included in the bill, data protections, and other protections that would maybe perhaps talk about predictive diagnoses where you're diagnosing a child 2, 3, 4 years ahead. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the gentleman to your right, sir, you had want to provide a comment as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, please identify yourself and provide your comment. And then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Caleb Stromquist. I'm from a constituent of District 1A. I'm from Roseau, so I drove always to come
welcome,
here.
Welcome to you. Glad you made it here safely.
Yeah, and I came down, and I'm not familiar with or that. Used to. I might move over.
As long as you're in front of a microphone, you're good.
Sounds good.
Either one. Yep.
Anyway, I haven't done a whole lot of this either. So, but this kind of thing is pretty important. And anyway, the voluntary services for newborns, pregnant mothers, and children, voluntary services already do exist. If home visit bill is to create a means of informing families or directing them to those services, there are already, those services are available, and means of finding out about them are also readily available. They're posted in websites. They're oftentimes mailed directly to families already. They're in hospitals, doctor's offices, clinics, food banks, libraries, phone books, schools. Are home visits really about informing parents about available services? Or is this just a means of government getting a foot in the door? If this is a separate program, where is all the funding for a program like this coming from? That was covered a little bit. And what is the trade-off? It's a lot of money. Would it not ultimately come out of our own pockets, taxpayers' money? If this is a separate, if the trade-off giving over control of how we run our homes or raise our children to government-run agencies? Is inclusion in these programs going to include all kinds of undeclared prerequisites? Like was brought up, what is the requirements of some of these services and things? At the very least, we ought to be concerned about the data collection that we know will take place with this sort of program, and we should be concerned with how our personal data will be used. Similar types of programs are already collecting massive amounts of personal data on children and their families. The bill speaks of a type of scoring or rating system. It's an evidence-based bill. And the program. So that speaks of collecting it. And it also must therefore be critically analyzed, resulting in the profiling of children, parents, and the family as a whole. If data collection isn't the main focus of home visit programs, then why would every state bill posted include this topic? We wonder if bill sponsors would consider adding opt-in consent and transparency clauses before personal information is collected and shared. I realize that it was mentioned that in the presentation and upon asking questions that requires consent, a parental consent for data collection, but that wording is not included in the bill. I would like to see that in the bill.
Mr. Stromquist, I'm hoping to fit one more testifier in before we have to recess at 9:30. So if you could,
okay.
If you wouldn't mind wrapping up.
I have a few more points to cover. Okay. And
if you could cover them real quick,
speed it up a little bit.
Real quickly, if you can, okay. Yeah, because I do want to fit somebody else in before we have to recess.
If data collection, we wonder if you could include that directly. Personal property personal rights, personal privacy. Your home is your property and should be protected against warrantless search and seizure. Your data should also be your property. Under federal law, PPRA surveys collecting students' personal beliefs on sensitive topics must have prior informed parental consent. Home visits and mental health screening should be no different. And the bill is very vague in regards to these crucial points. What if you refuse home visits? Will this turn into a big red flag that labels you as a risk? Still, ultimately, this is a government-run program, which is strongly inclined to be self-serving in very critical ways. I'm not as concerned with the bill, but how it will be implemented. Not done yet.
Mr. Jumbo, I kind of need you to be done very, very soon here, because I want to make sure, because I know other folks have driven long distance too, I want to make sure we can fit them in. So if you could wrap up.
What if you really can't say no? What if this home visit bill becomes mandatory, gets changed like a similar voluntary bill did in the state of Washington? The Washington HB 1491, the Early Start Act, was changed in the legislative process, and the bill reads voluntary in some areas, but also removed the word voluntary in another area, resulting in it becoming voluntary. How will this kind of program impact our religious freedoms and freedoms we have to train and teach our children the way we as parents feel is right? I'm seeing a pattern behind those who promote this sort of top-down structure early education. I'm not speaking strictly in terms of home visits, but that structure. Whether for preschool fours or birth to threes or home visiting, the general idea that I'm getting from those behind programs like this and other essentially identical bills like First 1,000 Days is a mindset that children would be better off in a school setting away from their parents. It is not hard to draw a connection to any number of socialist, communist, and fascist governments who gathered in all the children while pushing off parents. And
thank you, Mr.
Those who fail to learn from history are condemned to repeat it.
Thank you, Mr. Stromquist. Thank you so much.
In closing,
you kind of need to close, Mr. Stromquist. please.
These kinds of amendments would infringe on the rights we have long held as parents to make decisions regarding the health, protection, and education of our children. We need to ensure that these inalienable rights remain in the hands of parents, for we will surely not receive them back again once they are thus relinquished. I implore you as representatives not to vote in favor of any proposed amendment that would create or accept further incremental or expansive funding for home visiting, 4-year to preschool, or birth to three education through bill passage or acceptance of federal grants or in writing new grants.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stromquist, and my apologies for that. And Mr. Stromquist and members, we're going to have to be coming back to address this. I do want to make sure we fit in the additional testifier now. I wanted one more testifier now. But so if you wish to be addressing us further later, please feel free to, but I do want to make sure. And so please do identify yourself for the record, and please proceed. I want to make sure to fit you in now. So
I'll be super fast.
So no, that's fine.
My name is Elizabeth Bankard. I'm the owner and director of Here We Grow Early Childhood Center. And even though my shirt says I'm a lobbyist, I'm not a paid lobbyist. The movement is about citizens taking their voices back. My concerns are with the Delete All Amendment, points 2.1 and 2.2, when we talk about health equity. When we talk about health equity, I feel like what we need to talk about is what this is actually about, and what this is actually about is human capital. And if you look at the World Bank, there's actually a 3-minute video, and this ties directly into my work of early childhood, because health equity and educational experiences starting from birth on are all part of human capital, which, as we all know, Art Rolnick is big on in this state. My concern is when you start assigning numbers to individuals, you start to determine what their worth is. And the mass amounts of data that Representative Franzen asked for and kind of was danced around for the third time I've seen happen now in various committees, you have to ask where that data is going and who's going to own the data, and is the data being sold on a global market? And the answer is yes. The other issue that I take issue with is 2.15 and 2.17. You're expanding this money, our tax dollars, to go to nonprofit organizations. Mini Minds is a nonprofit organization. And Initiative Foundations actually are nonprofit organizations. Initiative Foundations are listed as funding sources on the Mini Minds website. Sorry. And the Mini Minds website lists home visiting as one of their main objectives. So our tax dollars are going to fund an Initiative Foundation, which is going to fund Mini Minds, which is driving the agenda. At least if I were to donate directly to a nonprofit, I'd get a tax credit. But clearly we're circumventing the system. And one has to ask yourself why the lobbyists, such as Close Gaps by Five, and other individuals who started programs such as Parent Aware, who make over $70,000 a year if you look to public records, are driving this along with our tax dollars. So I take a big issue with things that are coming to light, and that is, I feel, my job to bring them to light, because my tax dollars are funding my demise, and I'm not a fan.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And for your persistence in being here and sharing your thoughts, and Mr. Stromquist too for his persistence. So members, we are done for now. What we've done is we've secured a room, room 200, I believe, is the room. We'll recess to the call of the chair. I'm guessing that there's questions that folks have. I should look at all members, because perhaps there aren't any questions, and then we'd be done now and simply lay the bill over. Maybe we can do that. But am I correct? So actually, maybe I should ask that. First, were there anybody else in the public who had wanted to testify? I didn't think so. Maybe there is, no? And are there any questions from members? Because if there are, what we'll do is we'll recess and address those questions later. Oh, there is. You do want to testify. I wonder. Okay, fine. No, let's do that. As you're walking up, I'll just ask members, did you have questions up to this point? I was kind of guessing that folks do, but perhaps they don't. Oh, I'm not seeing any from, okay, yeah, there'll be a couple quick ones. Okay, well, why don't you introduce yourself begin your testimony or share your thoughts.
My name is Amanda Kowalski. It's AmandaKowalski. I am a stay-at-home mom to four children. I've had two hospital births and two home births. My first birth, I did have a home visit. It was something that I had requested. They had offered it to me in the hospital. And I was really honestly disappointed with the service that I received. The home visitor came, and the data collection really does take up a really large portion of time. I actually asked her like a half hour in if we were done yet, because I had my baby, I needed to feed her. I was really stressed out. What I really wanted was help with breastfeeding. And honestly, over half of the visit was a packet that I had to talk about with things I had already covered with my doctor about how I was feeling and things like that. Things about my family, things about all those kinds of things. So in the future, I didn't request that service again, because when I got home, I didn't get it covered monetarily because I was not on MA, even though I could have been. I wasn't informed, honestly. My husband made, I think, $38,000 that year, and under the MA guidelines, I would have qualified as a pregnant woman, but I had no idea. So that birth cost me, I think, over $1,500 because I had good insurance, but it was a lot for us. And I didn't realize when they billed me that there would be a mother and a child bill. So they covered one but not the other. So I wound up with like another $110 bill that I hadn't planned on. But anyways, they didn't really help me. The nurse was not very skilled, I felt, with breastfeeding. Who really helped me was La Leche League. And what I really wish would have happened was that I would have been informed of the programs that were there, and that program just was useless. So when I'm sitting here listening to you talk about these women in really stressful situations, and picturing a government employee essentially coming in and asking them, or you know, an extension of the government that's going to report back to fill out a packet that's going to take you a half an hour, and then have them look at to see if you know, there's plugs in your outlets and if your crib sheet is fitted on right and stuff. It feels more like a test to me than a help. So that's just my perspective. Thank you.
Ms. Kowalski, thank you for sharing your experience with us. That's really helpful. Thank you. So maybe I'll just clarify, Representative Bonner, that this is entirely voluntary. There's no registration or referral or connection with schools, as far as I know, or with Help Me Grow. And I'm seeing you nodding and agreeing with that. Okay.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And Representative Franson is just making the point. I want to make sure it gets recorded from Representative
Franson. Well, I'm just saying the nonprofits that aren't listed in here, so we wouldn't know if Here We Grow or these Help Me Grow is even part of it because it's not listed in the bill yet. We won't know until after the grants are awarded.
Representative Franson is saying that as a Help Me Grow, we wouldn't know. But I think Help Me Grow wouldn't be a program that would apply for a grant to do home visiting. It's sort of a totally separate thing, is my understanding. So are there any other questions or members? Because we may not then have to come back at this point. And reminding everyone, both members and members of the audience. Oh, Representative Heisman does have something.
Representative Heisman's going to have a number of questions.
Okay, good, Representative Heisman. I kind of assume so. So in that case, members, what we're going to do is we're going to recess to room 200. It'll be to the call of the chair. It'll be at some point after session. And then a reminder for, I guess, especially members of the public, that the bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in a division report that'll go to the HHS committee. But I think it's important we explore the issues that were raised, and Representative Heisman will have some questions, maybe others as well. So with that, members, we are recessing to the call of
Mr. Chair, hang on.
Pardon me?
I think that I can get my questions answered offline.
Representative Heisman says he thinks he'd get his questions answered offline. It's and Representative Heisman, don't feel any, I mean, we can do it relatively briefly after session two, so I don't want you to feel any pressure. There certainly were important issues raised, and this will be an ongoing conversation as well, of course, but feel very free. Representative Heisman, up to you.
I misunderstood. We'll go ahead and come back.
Okay, we will come back. Okay, so we're going to recess to the call of the chair. Thank you, members, and many thanks to members of the public as well, and Ms. Reckinger.
So reconvening the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. And we do have, I suppose, continue to have a quorum. So we've got Representative Bonner up front, and we're moving to member questions now. And Representative Heisman, I know that you had some. We'll start with you and then move to anybody else that we want. So Representative Heisman.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Launching right in.
Please do.
Representative Bonner, just we're looking at a couple of different things here, and definitions is part of it. But I think I'll start with a question. And I'm hoping you have both the amended version and the original. That's possible. I saw that there was some changes in the original compared to the amended version, and I just wanted to know why. And so I'd be specifically looking at the original version in 1.13. And what I see missing in the DE is a line there that specifically mentions that the programs, I think, are targeted culturally or ethnically, and that's no longer in the language in the amended version, and I was just wondering why that isn't being included.
Representative Bonner, it looks like you've got a friend up there as well, so it looks like maybe she won't. So if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura LaCroix-DeLoon, and I am the coordinator for the Minnesota Coalition for Targeted Home Visiting. Representative, to your question specifically, we worked with the Department of Health, we worked with the county and tribal health departments across the state and some of our model programs to find language that was consistently found in statute. And the reference that we had formerly on line 1.3, as you mentioned, it was difficult to have definitions around that and implement consistently across the state. And so we opted to utilize language that was already provided in statute and agreed upon language.
And Ms. LaCroix-DeLoon, you're referencing line 1.13, I think, rather than line 1.3.
In the original bill.
In the original bill, 1.13. Okay, Representative Heisman.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate that clarification. I didn't understand why that might have been moved and changed. So I might transition now, if it's okay, to another question.
Representative Heisman, it sounds like Ms. Yeah. LaCroix-DeLoon may have something to add on that, if that's okay with
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair and Representative, sorry, one more clarification. Part of what we were afforded the opportunity with this bill and with this delete all is we had a minimum amount of language that was in rider, and now that we're codifying it, it allowed us to have the opportunity to define these things. So you'll see some of the original language in House File 1226. We tried to bring as much of the original language forward from on the rider, but as we worked with research and worked with the department, we realized we had a real opportunity to just get it right. Sometimes it, you know, the language is compromised over time in a rider, and that's what we had previously in rider language.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be moving now to the DE since we got that cleared up. And some of the definitions, and I'll start in line 1.16. Trying to figure out here what exactly is, and I know that we had a presentation, Mr. Chair, earlier on some of this, so we may be having to kind of draw back on some of what we may have heard. But evidence-based home visiting program, how are we defining evidence-based home?
Ms. LaCroix-DeLune, or Representative Bonner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the language here, what we are trying to do is be consistent with the language that our Department of Health staff, Don Reckinger, mentioned earlier today. So these definitions are consistent with what HRSA uses to help identify evidence-based programs. So we wanted to bring that forward and codify that as well.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is who makes the determination that a program is evidence-based or evidence-informed.
Ms. LaCroix-DeLune.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. In this case, what we are referring to is the part of the presentation you heard this morning where Ms. Reckinger mentioned there were 14 to 17 different evidence-based programs. Again, we're using those that have been defined by HRSA as evidence-based. There are six that have been identified in Minnesota. So by moving this language forward, we would say those six that are being supported through the Department of Health would meet that criteria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question is coming up, of course, because, and I'm sure some members, of course, heard the testimony, and you probably did as well. How is information being protected? And we're trying to make absolutely sure as best we can, and there's still, I think, a lot of questions as to determining that there's no possible way to work backwards through a third-party system to determine who's who. And to me, that there's maybe not an answer that is going to satisfy that specific question at this point, but I do want to bring it up in public testimony. That's part of the reason that I brought us to this. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
No problem, Mr.
Situation. But, of course, privacy is a very sensitive issue, and that's why we're probably still here talking about this. And so I would add to that, is there any place, and you had already kind of referenced it, I think, but is there any place you can point directly to where these evidence-based definitions were drawn from in this bill?
And Ms. LaCroix-DeLune, I know it looked like Representative Bonner had wanted to say something earlier, too, but why don't we get an answer to Representative Heisman's question? Yes, Ms. LaCroix-DeLune.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative. The evidence-based definition follows what HRSA uses, so the federal government, how they define the use of the federally funded evidence-based program. So we were trying to mirror that so we would be consistent here in Minnesota.
And Representative Bonner, it looked like you had something to say before.
It can wait.
Okay, Representative Bonner. I'm Representative Heisman, you still have the floor.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I will go ahead and allow another member to ask.
Okay, and no problem. And I actually want to say, as long as you said that before, that that members absolutely should have the time to ask questions. So I don't mind at all us coming back. I'm apologetic to everybody else for just the way the timing worked out. But no, you deserve to have questions answered, and that's what we're doing here now. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I was thinking back to the testimony this morning and what we're talking about evidence-based programs. And so, and because we were all there, it's a quiz, it seems like when they're talking about, they're saying these programs qualify for the grants because they are evidence-based. But I think what that meant is that the research has been done to show that they, you know, that there is, that they do demonstrate improvements in the ways that we wanted to see them demonstrate improvements. So in a sense, when we're talking about evidence-based, that's a past tense thing. That's what I understand from when they were talking about evidence-based programs in the presentation this morning.
Maybe we'll have Ms. LaCroix-DeLune, mm-hmm. if you've got anything you want to add or correct or adjust to how Representative Pryor characterized that. Looks like Jean.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that's fair to say. I mean, these are rigorously evaluated programs that have been proven time over and over again. I would say these are kind of like the gold star standard because they've been replicated in different communities across the country. So And each of these, I will just say about the privacy concern, each of these programs, I just want to really be clear, they are all voluntary, and that parents at any point in time can choose to opt out of a program and leave a program, as well as they can, decide which parts of the data that's being collected is collected. So we work really hard, whether the home visitor is a public health nurse or a social worker or a paraprofessional, we work really hard to allow families to have as much control over that process, because so much of the home visiting work happens because you have a strong relationship with that person. And if you would breach their trust on data, you would lose them as a client.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either to the author or the testifier, and I apologize for walking in late, but I'm wondering if you could explain what the link between using evidence-based practice and concerns about privacy might be.
Ms. LaCroix-DeLoon, Representative Bonner.
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
We could ask Representative Morrison to
clarify just a little bit more.
I'm not following Representative Heinzman's train of thought of what using evidence-based practices in these home visiting programs, how that potentially creates privacy issues.
And it may be that that's a question that's directed to Representative Heinzman, perhaps, to clarify his own question.
The short answer is there is no link.
Well, let's let Representative Heisman clarify his own question.
I don't want to create that.
Yeah, just make sure we understand, or if there's Representative Heisman, anything that you want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No problem.
And I don't know if folks are looking directly at the language here, but we see on line 1.6, definition of evidence-based home visiting program, which means a program that is based in a clear, consistent program, moving on to line 1.7, or model. And then it goes on further. And I think that the big concern is when we go and we drop down to line 1.17, evidence-informed home visiting program means a program that has data or evidence demonstrating a program's effectiveness. Well, as we were hearing in testimony earlier, because there was a number of folks that testified and shared their concern as to how a third party is going to be managing data. The first-hand folks are going to be, as I'm understanding it, looking at this evidence-based information, which is, I think, very direct, whereas where we're looking at informed evidence, and the testifier can correct me if I'm wrong, but informed evidence is going to be, in most cases, my understanding, a third party that is going to be looking at this information and making determinations without knowing necessarily who and identifying individual students, but still being able to generate information that's useful to the legislature. And here again, like I said, if the testifier would like to clarify, that's fine, but that's my understanding.
Maybe we'll have Ms. LaCroix-DeLoon, why don't you provide shed some light on this for us.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative. Thank you for clarifying that. There may just be some misunderstanding about what this language means here. To clarify, evidence-informed means that a program, it uses the evidence in their program design, so they build their program design based on evidence from these models, the evidence-based models on 1.6. But they haven't gone through the rigor of being connected to a university, so they can't call themselves a model or an evidence-based program. So they have outcomes showing that they are working with families, working with kids, some of the same things, like developmental outcomes for the child or for the mother around maternal depression. All of that data is collected and de-identified when we talk about reporting back what we know. So you are, because this crosses over, right, so it's health-protected data, the data that we are interested in generally as a state is how it's aggregated together. So we go over and above to try to protect that individual level data, but it's really the de-identified aggregated data that helps us make policy decisions. So I think the point you're raising is valid because we want to protect people's data. And I would just say all the programs that we work with, whether it's local public health or nonprofits or tribal health, they follow all of those statutes. I mean, that would be a responsibility, or they would lose funding. And more importantly, they lose the trust of the families they're trying to serve, right? So we work really hard to honor that relationship. But the evidence-informed data, we're talking about aggregate-level data here. We're not talking about the individual data here.
Representative Heinzman.
I think what I heard was that I had that basically right. So I'm just to confirm.
Ms. LaCroix de Lune.
Mr. Sherbert, I'm sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
He was saying that he had this, that it's heard from you that was basically right.
That's what I'm hearing from you.
Sorry. Ms. LaCroix de Lune.
That
Ms. LaCroix de Lune, that you had what he, what Representative Heisman said as being basically correct.
No. I don't, Representative Heintzman, hopefully I can shed some light here a little bit. I think the assumption was made that this data was being shared with third parties, which it is not. You're not sharing identified data. Personal data, or PHI, or PII, personal health information, or personal identifiable information, cannot be shared under HIPAA privacy laws. So when you're talking about trying to establish whether something is effective, you can share data that is de-identified. So what that means, for those of you in the room who are not familiar with this, is so, for example, you could have a data set and you can pass on specific pieces of information. So, for example, if I want to know if something's effective, I might want to know how well five-year-olds do with a certain program. So I might pass on a unique identifier. I might pass on the age of the child. I might pass on information on the specific program that they're involved in, or a specific marker that shows the results of that program. But we would not be supplying specific identifiable information, such as we would not be passing on information like your address. We would not be passing on information such as a child's name. You would not pass on anything that could identify that child specifically. So you will know that a five-year-old participated in the program, and you will know perhaps the dates they participated in the program. And you can see other markers or results-based information from that program, but you will have no idea or way to trace who that individual child is or trace them back to their parents or where they live or any of that type of information. That's how de-identified data works.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
No, those are things I already knew. The issue is, and this is what we heard in testimony this morning, and part of the reason that I had questions beyond what we had already had an opportunity to ask, was that there are folks that believe that this information that is being, that is evidence-informed, which is being used to generate usable data for folks that might be in a third-party situation, could use to still identify individuals after that point. Now, that may not be the case, but I was wanting to try and get some more clarification to understand, because when we looked at the original language, that we transitioned away from, these definitions weren't there. That's why I was trying to figure out where those definitions came from and maybe why and who generated those. It doesn't mean that we're necessarily wrong, but I wanted to make that clarification, because if a third party could go back through de-identified information and determine who, based on dates and other information that was included, who you know, a student was. And that information doesn't go away. That lasts forever and ever. And I think it's an important issue to discuss further.
Ms. LaCroix de Lune, you want to comment on Representative Heintzman's concerns at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe your concerns are addressed in all the agreements that we have with families. But to your question about who helped create these definitions, there's the definitions were created together through the Minnesota Department of Health, the local public health association, the coalition that I support, and then some of the model programs who operate here in Minnesota. So several organizations and state agencies who do this work with home visitors across the state were involved in creating these definitions.
Representative Heintzman, are you move a couple of folks?
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, yeah. And I guess that would be my final comment, so to speak, on that issue. I wish that the state and federal government had an absolutely perfect, flawless record on this issue, but of course there are examples where that hasn't been the case, and so I think that's just an important part of this discussion.
And thank you for raising it, Representative Heintzman. We've got a couple other folks, and it may be that provokes more, and feel free to dive in at that point. So Representative Morrison, you're next up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Representative Bonner for bringing this bill forward and expanding this program for our really vulnerable parents and children to help get them off to a great start. So thank you so much for your work.
Okay. Representative Cotizza-Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify something I think I heard from Mrs. Reckinger this morning and then again from you, Mrs. LaCroix-DeLune, just earlier. So not only are these programs completely voluntary, so even if a doctor were to recommend that a child participate in this program or that a mother receive home visiting from someone at the hospital, someone through a different community organization, that family has the choice to say, no thanks, I appreciate the information, but I'm going to pass.
Ms. LaCroix-DeLune.
Correct. Great, thank you. So if they began the program and decided to no longer continue, they could opt out of the program at any point, correct?
Ms. LaCroix-DeLune.
Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
And they also, if they're concerned about data privacy, could say, I actually don't want any of my data shared, or you can share these pieces of my data. So they ultimately have whole control over what could be used in the program as de-identifiable data. Is that correct?
Ms. LaCroix-DeLune.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they have control over what data is collected. Yes, absolutely. And at any point, they could even ask to see what data is collected.
Okay. Representative Cotizza-Witun. I should say, by the way, the two of you have very tongue twister names that I'm struggling with. Cotizza-Witun, LaCroix-DeLune. Anyway, Representative Cotizza-Witun. Hanging on for dear life.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those were just really important points of clarity. So I just wanted to make sure that families do have that control and they can make those decisions for themselves at any given point, participating in the program or not, sharing the data or not.
Okay.
Thank you.
And any further comment on that, Representative or Ms. LaCroix-DeLune, Representative Cotizza-Witun's points at all?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
You agree with them, I guess?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? I guess we closed public testimony before. We had that. And I want to echo Representative Morrison's point that of thanks to Representative Bonner and to Ms. LaCroix-DeLune, who's worked on this issue for a long time. Home visiting is just proven itself, I'd say proven both through evidence-based programs, evidence-informed programs, to have an amazing impact on families. And I know these proposals have the support of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, and I think they have you've got Republican support authors in the Senate, I believe, and so just some pretty amazing programs. So unless there's anything else, with that, I will lay this bill over for possible. Oh, pardon me. There is somebody. Representative. Oh, okay. We're holding off. Okay. Over for possible inclusion in HHS division report. And then with that, we are adjourned. Oh, pardon me.
That's what
I'm missing something. Okay. Sorry. Yes.
No, okay. I did want to bring up something from this morning.
That
I
yeah.
I want to quickly, briefly touch on.
Please.
Members might have noticed that we didn't move the minutes this morning. And Mr. Chair, I just wanted to confirm. I think folks have probably had an opportunity to kind of develop a plan as to how to work on an issue that I think might have been a part of the minutes that we were potentially going to move forward with. And I wanted to see if we did have a plan, and I guess I'm expecting that we're going to be probably hearing some bills again. Is that?
We will be hearing, yes, we will be hearing bills again in future meetings. This won't be the last one.
Bills that we have had, we did hear, as there was some technical issues with how we progress.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman. So, and what you're referring to is that in a draft of the minutes, at our meeting on Tuesday, we had moved a bill prior to having a quorum. Then we had a quorum and then had an amendment added. We have checked with House Research. I was going to talk with you all afterwards about this, but and we've been told that the action of adding the amendment after the quorum essentially is a technical error, and to confirm that what should have happened is that we have the quorum, we then move after having the quorum. We do have information from House Research saying that that should be fine. 1.2 is that bill was later for possible inclusion, so language would be reappearing in a division report. I'm happy to talk about that offline. It may be that what we do want to do is to bring that back up. It seems like it may not be necessary, in fact, but I'm happy to talk about it. I did want to make sure the minutes were actually reflecting those steps, and that's why we weren't going to address those minutes today. But Representative Heintzman, does that address your concern? Or?
If to an extent it does, Mr. Chair. I do think that in light of Mason's 500, 502, and 505.
Oh, my goodness. I guess you, Representative Heintzman. Oh, that's good.
We probably should be looking at a technical fix that would involve reposting those particular bills.
One moment. The CA's got something here. But, and so, Representative Heintzeman, that may well be necessary. As I said, we did get information I'm happy to send to you from House Research that's indicating they thought that it should be fine. But it may well be that just to be on the safer side, we do exactly what you're describing. And I appreciate you bringing that up. And as I say, that language in particular would end up in a division report regardless. But, you know, but if that ends up being a concern, I would certainly think that we could do that. So let's, if we can, send you what House Research had to say about it, you and staff, and then it may well make some sense to do that. And I appreciate you raising that now. So anything further on that, feel free.
No, I just think that that would make a lot of sense to go ahead and revisit those things. As folks know, we take a lot of pride here in doing things by the book, and that avoids legal challenges and other issues down the road. So I thank you for that consideration.
No, and thank you, Representative Heintzeman. And I guess my only hesitation is only in that we also, in general, the House Research tends to be, and I know they don't like being put too much in that position, but generally, you know, sort of like as they describe things, we go along. But I'll send it to you and we can take a look, but it may well be that what you're describing makes sense. And I do appreciate you raising it. Any other issues from members? Not seeing anything. So at that point, we will adjourn. And many thanks, members, for coming back for your patience today.